Hi, it's the show on KJZZ. I'm Steve Goldstein.
And I'm Mark Brody, and this is our podcast version of the program. The show is one of our original productions. It's a curated program of news and features from Phoenix and the state, along with national and international stories.
You can also find segments and additional information at theshow.kjzz.org.
Thanks for listening to the podcast. Good afternoon. It's the show on KJZZ. I'm Mark Brody, along with Steve Goldstein. In Valley traffic, on the 101 northbound, the Broadway Road exit ramp is restricted. Elsewhere, 101 southbound, crash at Elliott. On the 10 westbound, a crash at 59th Avenue. And on the 101 eastbound, on the 19th Avenue on-ramp. Well, it's going to be relatively cool today with a high of only 105. You never like to hear that. Up to 111 tomorrow. An excessive heat warning starts at 10 o'clock Sunday morning. Look for a high of 118 on Sunday, 119 on Monday. Right now, it's 99 degrees at KJZZ. The Tenderfoot fire could be 100% contained as soon as Sunday after beginning more than a week ago in Yarnell. Today, representatives from multiple agencies gathered in the tiny town to talk about the fire's progress and what factors led to such a quick and positive outcome. Yarnell firefighter Aaron Cussum says an effort to build a defensible line around town that's clear of heavy vegetation helped crews fight the blaze.
It was in people's backyards. It doesn't get any closer than that. We were right up against it, and that, you know, that's our job to kind of put ourselves in between the fire and people's property. But the Good Fuels program gave us time to kind of sit down and really think about how we wanted to fight this instead of just jumping in.
The Fuel Breaks project was funded by state and federal grants after the 2013 Yarnell Hill fire devastated the town and killed 19 firefighters. The Tenderfoot fire has now burned 4,100 acres and is 90% contained. Presumptive Republican presidential nominee Donald Trump will be in Phoenix tomorrow for an afternoon rally at Veterans Memorial Coliseum in Phoenix. And law enforcement is getting ready for the event and the crowds it's expected to bring, both in support of and opposition to the candidate. Matthew Casey from KJZZ's West Valley Bureau is with me for more on this. And Matt, what kind of law enforcement presence will there be at the Coliseum tomorrow?
Heavy. Generally speaking, they expect hundreds of law enforcement officers to be out there. People going into the event will go through metal detectors and pat-downs. Weapons are not allowed inside. Anyone trying to bring them in will be turned away but not arrested. Captain Damon Cecil is with the Arizona Department of Public Safety. He wouldn't go into specifics, but he said that law enforcement are drawing on past experiences to prepare security for this event.
We are prepared for any type of contingency. As I said earlier this morning, we prepare for the worst, but hope for the best. And that's really where we're at with this.
So, Matt, is there anything that law enforcement is on the lookout specifically? Or are they just sort of doing crowd control there?
Captain Cecil says that protests are dynamic situations and can be unpredictable. And DPS's goal is to protect Trump supporters and protesters alike. He's encouraging everyone to be respectful. The biggest challenge for law enforcement is that they can't arrest people for thoughts or most kinds of speech.
What we have to do is we have to keep them on our radar. We have to watch them and diligently observe their behavior. And if it crosses the line to where it's criminal and then we can take action, then we're going to do so.
Matt, is there a particular concern that DPS is expressing? I mean, is there anything specific that they maybe gotten reports about or anything specific that they're concerned about?
A motorcycle organization is planning to protect Trump protesters, according to local reports, but law enforcement says they have spoken with them.
They're not going to be patrolling the area. What they're simply going to be doing is escorting folks from the parking lot here on the fairgrounds and moving them to the venue at the Coliseum.
Now, Matt, in the midst of what will potentially be a heated situation, you also have the actual heat. It's going to be very, very warm tomorrow. What is law enforcement saying about how that might play into things?
Captain Cecil says that the heat is actually their biggest concern. The event is happening at the hottest time of the day. They're encouraging people to start hydrating now, to dress appropriately. Water bottles will be allowed inside the Coliseum, but you cannot bring coolers.
That's KJZZ's Matthew Casey talking about how law enforcement is preparing for tomorrow afternoon's Donald Trump rally at Veterans Memorial Coliseum in Phoenix. Matt, thanks.
Thank you, Mark.
It could be a record-breaking weekend for the Valley with temperatures approaching 120. The next few days could also, by the way, break existing records for the number of social media posts of dashboard thermometers and attempts to fry eggs on the sidewalk. So what's behind this heat wave? Two words, mega ridge. Here to explain is Angela Fritz, deputy weather editor at The Washington Post. She also writes for the Capital Weather Gang blog. And Angela, what is this weather phenomenon that's going to make Phoenix, the Phoenix area, feel like the surface of the sun over the next few days?
Yeah, that's true. To be quite honest, it is literally just high pressure. And that tends to be what Phoenix is most familiar with when they think back to their most dangerous heat waves, is just a ridge of high pressure that is persistent and it's strong, and it allows the sun to bake the earth such that, you know, temperatures rise to near record levels.
So for those of us who are not meteorologists, does that basically just mean that things are staying where they are and there's nothing getting in the way of the sun, as you say, baking the ground here?
Yes. Yeah, so under high pressure, you're not going to get any clouds in the southwest, and that's clouds are what tend to keep us a little bit cooler. You know, over here on the East Coast in D.C., we can have heat waves and clouds at the same time. But in Phoenix, when you have a heat wave, you have no clouds, and so there's really no chance for relief. So if you need to find shade, it needs to be under a tree or it needs to be in a house, because you're not going to get it from the sky.
So since you are in D.C., and D.C. is notorious for having fairly unpleasant summers, as Phoenix is, let's talk about this sort of age-old debate versus it's a dry heat or that doesn't really matter. What do you make of that?
Right. So I had the same question earlier this week when I started to look at your forecast, and I thought, you know, I did a little bit of writing on it, and people said, oh, well, it's a dry heat. And I said, well, you know, that doesn't totally make sense to me. On the one hand, you know, all things being equal, 90 degrees with 100% humidity is terrible. It feels terrible.
Sure.
There's nothing good about that. And 90 degrees with very little humidity feels much better. However, when you get up to 120 degrees, your body still cannot really adapt to that, because you are losing so much moisture. And that's how we keep our bodies cool, is that we sweat, and then that sweat evaporates into the air. And evaporation is actually, it's a cooling process. And so at 120 degrees, you're just losing a lot more water. And so that's why it's so critically important for people to continue to drink as much as they can during this time, especially if they need to be outside, which I don't recommend.
So let's alert all the folks in the Mid-Atlantic that, yes, summer in Phoenix may, in fact, be worse than summer on the East Coast. Can we settle this once and for all now?
I'm totally okay with that. That's fine. I don't want 120 degrees on either coast.
Yeah, 120 degrees in D.C. would be really, really bad in the summer.
Yes, it would.
A question that a lot of folks have, I think, in Arizona is that, you know, we hear so much about polar vortex, and when there's a big snowstorm on the East Coast, everybody in the country knows about it. Are we finally starting to get to the point where, when it's going to be 120 degrees in Phoenix, or even if it doesn't quite approach that, do people in the rest of the country care about that, or do people just assume, yeah, Phoenix is really hot in the summer, what's the big deal?
No, I think that this is pretty anomalous, and I think people are starting to pay attention to this, if only because, you know, at least those of us in the science community and those of us in the weather community are kind of scratching our heads now, saying, this is happening a lot more frequently. And I don't know if you all have noticed that out there, but, you know, we were looking back at some of the data and found that in the Southwest, the intensity of these high-pressure events has actually trended up over time. So we have about 60 or so years worth of data where we can look back at this, and almost all of the most extreme high-pressure events, in other words, the most extreme heat waves, have happened since 1980. And so that's why when we're talking about, you know, Phoenix could climb to 120 degrees, that will be amongst its top five, you know, hottest temperatures on record. And all of the top five hottest have happened since 1990. Okay, and so that's why we're kind of looking at this thing. This is getting interesting, because it just seems to get hotter and hotter and hotter each heat wave you have.
Angela Fritz is deputy weather editor for The Washington Post. Angela, try to stay cool on our behalf this weekend. Thanks so much for your time.
Thanks. My pleasure.
And in response to this weekend's mega ridge, air conditioners will be cranked up and people will take refuge indoors. But not everyone can find shelter from the heat so easily. The show's Annika Klein explores what it's like to be homeless in the heat.
At 3 p.m. each day, Central Arizona Shelter Services, better known as CAS, opens its doors. A line extends outside in the sun as people wait to enter through security and finally get some relief in the AC.
I've been in Phoenix 7 years.
Asiya Abdul-Wali sets her stuff down, a backpack and a canvas bag.
You have to drink a lot of water. I found that out the first summer I was here. I passed out at the bus stop.
Now she knows better. She says she drinks 10 to 15 bottles of water a day, the small plastic kind. She gets them from Cass and sometimes other places.
I usually carry two bottles with me everywhere I go. No more, because water's heavy.
And water is just the start to avoiding a relentless heat.
In Maricopa County, the homeless population is 10 times more likely to die from a heat-related illness than the population at large.
David Smith is with Cass. They're ramping up a big water bottle donation drive right now, but the number of beds is always the same.
We have 470 beds at Cass, and every night they are full.
This is the case year-round, but in the summer, the number of people trying to get in is much higher. Smith says the overflow jumps by a couple hundred people in hot months. They're all looking for a respite. And that's just at night. During the day, they have to find other havens.
You're chased out of a lot of different places.
Keith Janata is staying at Cass tonight. He says during the day, he walks through a city filled with air-conditioned buildings. And few are welcoming to him.
You know, if you go to a business to try to cool off and you have a backpack with you, they deem you homeless right away and security sends to watch you when you're just trying to get a quick, breath of cold air.
This is why in 2005, the Maricopa Association of Governments, or MAG, created the Heat Relief Network. It's a unified effort to create spots in the valley where anyone in need can get water and cool down. There are libraries, nonprofits, government buildings, churches. Abdul Wali says she uses the maps they hand out to find where to go.
It tells you all the little posts where they set up, and they give water, they give sunscreen, they give hats.
And MAG is updating that map because just a few days ago, 40 new locations joined. And this weekend, the network's emergency stations will open too. But some people like Janata say they don't know where to go beyond places like Cass. What frustrates him most about the heat is that he feels stuck.
You want to better yourself and go get a job, but you could die out there. I'm diabetic. And if I don't get enough water and make sure that my sugar levels are at the right spot, I could die out there.
Sometimes you have no choice but to go outside, however miserable it is. That's what Linda Morris and the congregation at the First Pentecostal Church realized. The South Phoenix Church joined the Heat Relief Network years ago, and Morris says they don't get that many people coming to them for heat relief.
So we go looking for them periodically, load up the coolers with cold water, and just drive the streets and find people who are out.
Basically, bringing the refuge to people where they're at.
When you see people at bus stops, and it's 110, 115 degrees and they're sitting there, they have to wait for the bus. Why not stop and give them a cool drink of water?
It's one of the best survival tools in the sweltering heat. But the people I spoke with are worried about this weekend. When highs creep up toward 120 degrees, carrying an extra water or putting on some more sunscreen only does so much. On days like that, the most important thing is that everyone has somewhere to go to get out of the heat. For the show, I'm Anika Klein.
Good afternoon. It's the show on 91.5. I'm Mark Brody with Steve Goldstein.
Earlier today, the Democratic National Convention Committee convened the Southwest Democratic Platform Forum in Phoenix. The platform is the formal statement of goals that define what a party and its members stand for. Some years, depending on the party leaders and presidential nominees, the process can get a little contentious. The CEO of the 2016 Democratic National Convention is Reverend Leah Daughtry. She's in the Valley for the Platform Forum, and she joins me. Reverend Daughtry, is this process open to any Democrat?
Absolutely. We had an unprecedented open process this year where we allowed Democrats from all over the country, encouraged folks to go on our website and submit testimony either in writing through the website or by video, or they had the option of coming to testify in person. So we've had a very robust process. In our first session, we heard from witnesses, about 60 different witnesses. We'll hear from 60 more this time. The process is still open, and Democrats can continue to submit testimony and submit their ideas, their thoughts, their vision for what the party ought to stand for by going to our website, www.demconvention.com. And there's a tab there that says platform, and you can send in your ideas.
And how diverse is it in two ways? One, in terms of the backgrounds of the people who are contributing, but also in terms of their points of view.
It's very diverse. This time, for the first time ever, the party chair asked each of our candidates to submit names of who would serve on the drafting committee. So Senator Sanders has folks on, as well as Secretary Clinton. And, of course, the party itself has some names as well. So you have a wide diversity. Very broad thinking, policy positions. Each person brings their own level of expertise and interests and passion to the process, and that's helping us to have a very robust discussion, and we're looking forward to a very inclusive document.
Certainly in this state, we now have more independents than we do either Republicans or Democrats, if we break it down in terms of percentage. And I think a lot of other states are turning that way as well. In your eyes, does that affect in any way how the platform goes, or is the platform really for committed Democrats and not really for the general public?
Well, the platform is the Democratic Party's statement of values, positions, and principles. So ultimately, it will reflect where we think the vision of the party ought to go. But, you know, in truth, we don't put a litmus test on who comes to testify. Many of the folks who come are not-for-profit groups who have 501c3s who do not take a partisan position on issues, but they do have issues that they care very deeply about around climate or health or safety. And so we don't preclude them just because they cannot endorse. We still want to hear expert opinion from them. The general public as well, you know, we don't make you check a box that says I'm a Democrat, but we hope that you understand if you're participating that this is about the Democratic Party's statement of principles. So ultimately, that will be what we're driving to in the final document.
There are four regional forums for the platform. We found that kind of interesting. Is there a particular reason for that other than to represent the entire country? Is there a feeling that maybe in certain areas of the country, people are focused on mostly similar issues, but in some cases, maybe a little bit different?
You know, we wanted to really take this around the country so that we could encourage American Democrats from all over to participate and not have to go too far from home to do that. We also recognize that in different areas of the country, there are issues that may ring more important. Certainly, I'm in Arizona, Phoenix today. It's 85 degrees at 8 in the morning. Climate change and the energy, the environment are certainly issues that are important here. Gun safety, we know we had a tragic shooting some years ago that affected Congresswoman Gabby Giffords. Those sorts of issues, I'm sure, are front of mind for Arizonans and folks in this region. But primarily, we wanted to be able to hold these hearings in places that folks could get to easily from their area of the country and not have to travel, you know, one coast or the other to be able to participate. So our goal was to really increase participation.
The Reverend Leah Daughtry is the CEO of the 2016 Democratic National Convention. She's in Phoenix for the Southwest Democratic Platform Forum.
It's the show on 91.5. Thanks for listening this afternoon. Along with the Takeaways, John Hockenberry, I'm Mark Brody. For the people of the UK, there is mourning in the aftermath of the murder of Labour Member of Parliament Jo Cox. She was shot and stabbed in her Northern England constituency by a suspect who may represent a latent violent impulse in British society. Killed 1 week shy of the referendum over continued British membership in the European Union, Cox represented something in British politics as rare as this horrible crime. Here's a bit of her speech in the House of Commons in January, where she celebrated her multi-ethnic community and introduced herself to the nation.
Batley and Spurn is a gathering of typically independent, no-nonsense, proud Yorkshire towns and villages. Our communities have been deeply enhanced by immigration, be it Irish Catholics across the constituency or Muslims from Indian Gujarat or Pakistan, principally from Kashmir. And whilst we celebrate our diversity, the thing that surprises me time and time again as I travel around the constituency is that we are far more united and have far more in common than that which divides us.
Jo Cox's killer allegedly yelled Britain First, the name of a far-right group, before the attack, and questions about motive here have caused both pro- and anti-Brexit camps to suspend their campaigns, a move that could have global implications, according to Simon Hicks, professor of political science at the London School of Economics.
I mean, it's a little early to tell and to understand what the impact of this will be on the debate. I mean, I think a lot of it depends on how they identify the motive of the killer. We already know that he had some connections to some extreme right groups. We have not had exactly his motive for murdering her confirmed. Was it because he was opposed to the fact that she was a very prominent advocate of refugee and migrant interests in the UK? Or was it because she was a very prominent local politician campaigning to remain in the EU? If it's the latter of those two things, I think that could have quite a profound impact on the campaign. If it's the former, then I think we will just have a period of mourning and early next week they'll just return to normal, but perhaps with the rhetoric toned down for the last few days of the campaign.
And the rhetoric has been very, very high. There's been, you know, charges of fear-mongering and excessive sort of charges and countercharges in the debate. Explain why the reason perhaps that virtually all of the UK is on pins and needles over the developments in this case is just because of how rare a crime like this is in the UK as compared with, say, the United States, where this happens, you know, every other day.
Yeah. First of all, gun crime in general is very, very low in the UK compared to not just the United States, but most other developed countries in the world. And so one of the big questions is, how did the guy get a gun? Nobody has a gun. Where did it come from? And the second thing is, it's just extremely rare that there is an attack on a politician. We had an attack on the last time a politician was murdered was by the IRA in the 1980s. So, you know, we haven't and we've only had a stabbing, an attempted stabbing on a politician about 10 years ago. So it's extremely rare. The other thing, of course, that really is tragic for people is this was a young, very dynamic woman with very small, very young children, aged 3 and 5. A very committed local politician, and she sort of epitomized all that was good about politics and somebody committed to public service and wanting to go into politics because she really wanted to help people.
And indeed, extending upon the sentiments of Joe Cox's original speech in the House of Commons earlier this year, a new person to politics, but someone who celebrates the new diversity in the UK, who is not at all ambivalent about the ways in which the UK has changed and seemed almost to be excited about the future ahead.
Yeah, I mean, she represented a lot of what young British people feel. What we know is that Britain has become a very open, very liberal, very multi-religious, multi-ethnic place. And younger people in this country, we know from the survey data, seem to be far more happier with that and have a far more positive opinion of that than older generations do. And we're seeing that divide in the battle over whether Britain should remain in the EU, with older generations, in a sense, feeling the country has changed, it's been changing too fast, and they would like Britain to be independent, standing alone in the world, and protecting the interests of the British people, whereas the younger generation seem to be far more relaxed with the fact that Britain has become this very global, integrated, multi-ethnic, multi-racial community, and they feel very happy about that. They've grown up with mixed-race friends, they've grown up with friends with different religious views, and so they're used to that and they don't see a problem with that.
I also find it really striking what you referred to before. She's not, you know, some kind of political elite from the traditional channels of power in the UK. She's a mother, she's a very approachable person with a bio that seems to embrace rather than exclude.
Yes, and she was popular not just within her party. She was popular across the House of Commons. She was a very open, vivacious personality. What has also surprised me is how many conservative politicians have come out and told stories about how they met her in the tea room at the House of Commons, and she was always open to talking to people and always wanted to hear their views. And even if she disagreed, she would argue vociferously her point, but she was open to other people's opinions and other people's views. And she was really an advocate of very pluralist democratic politics. And, you know, since we had the expenses scandals in the House of Commons a few years ago, we've had a media and a public that's been very cynical about politicians. People assume that they're self-interested, they're venal, they're liars, they're cheats. And she really epitomizes the complete antithesis of that. And it reminds people that a lot of people who go into politics, a lot of people in her generation in their late 30s, early 40s, who go into politics because they're really politically committed people who are going to politics for the public service because they want to help people. And it's a very important reminder that we need to think about our politicians in a very different way than we've been thinking about them in recent years.
Simon Hicks, Professor of Political Science at the London School of Economics. Thanks so much.
You're welcome.
That's John Hockenberry at The Takeaway. Arizona will celebrate Juneteenth as an official state holiday for the first time tomorrow. The day commemorates the end of slavery in the U.S. The state legislature approved a bill earlier this year creating the holiday, although it's not a legal one. State Representative Reginald Boulding sponsored the bill.
Most people are familiar with the Emancipation Proclamation, which took place in 1863. What a lot of people aren't familiar with is that there were still several parts in the United States in which individuals were still slaves, particularly in Texas. So it wasn't until after 2 years after the Emancipation Proclamation, June 19, 1865, in which Union soldiers came to Galveston, Texas, and they let slaves know that they were freed. So Juneteenth is a day celebrating the true ending of slavery here in this country.
Was that just a matter of lack of communication that folks in Texas didn't know that this had happened?
So that's up for debate. You know, there's several different stories. Some people say that, you know, maybe messengers, they didn't want to give that information to individuals who were slaves. And some people may have not agreed with the Emancipation Proclamation. So there's a number of different stories of why that took place. But ultimately, there were many slaves who lost their lives during that 2-year period and here and thereafter. But this is definitely a day in which they were excited about, and we should be too.
What to you is the significance of Arizona celebrating this holiday now, especially given the state's relationship with the Martin Luther King holiday?
You know, what happened with Martin Luther King is something in which I think the state is still, it's an image in which this state still has to answer for regarding Martin Luther King holiday and all of the controversy that it caused. And by stepping forward and celebrating Juneteenth as a day of observance here, I think it helps Arizona take a next step in saying that we can be a tolerant state, that we can accept diversity from all cultures, all backgrounds. And I think it's really a step forward in shining a light here on Arizona for things that we could be proud of.
How will you be celebrating?
I'll be celebrating with the community at East Lake Park. There'll be the official Juneteenth state holiday event will be taking place here in downtown Phoenix from 4 to 9 p.m. So I'll be there celebrating with the community and really sharing stories about our history, but also looking forward at what's more to offer. Because in this day, we still have issues that we need to fight through. And just thinking about all of the sacrifices that our ancestors gave in the past should definitely ignite a flame in us to continue to push.
State Representative Reginald Boulding talking about Juneteenth holiday. Representative Boulding, thank you.
Thank you.
In KJZZ News at 2:35, if you're driving through Pima County, keep your cell phone away. KJZZ's Catherine Fritke reports the county's distracted driving law goes into effect today.
In a unanimous vote, the Pima County Board of Supervisors approved the ordinance, banning the use of cell phones while driving last month. The law is now in effect, but Courtney Rodriguez with Pima County says distracted drivers won't get in too much trouble right away.
There will be a 30-day grace period for enforcement efforts, and during this grace period, drivers will receive a written warning.
Following the grace period, those who violate the law could face a $100 fine. Catherine Fricke, KJZZ News.
Which cities suffer the most during a recession? How about several recessions? A new paper looks at how 50 U.S. metro areas, including Phoenix, fared during recessions between the 90s and the Great Recession. Phoenix, by the way, fared better than cities like Las Vegas, San Jose, and Detroit. Charles Gaskin is a regional economist at the Federal Reserve Bank of St. Louis and is an author of the paper. And Charles, for those cities most hard hit, was it one recession that really did them in, or was it a cumulative effect?
I think that, if you look at it clearly, the recession most recently in 2007, 2008, that was, you know, significantly deeper than the prior two recessions. So that's going to be a big driver in where the big pull down was in a lot of these places. But at the same time, if you look at the different cities, what you do see is some pretty stark differences between kind of the overall economies and the overall growth kind of over the time period. So we look kind of starting around 1990. And what you see is that, you know, in Phoenix, there's no real recession in the 90s. There was one in kind of the mid-2000s and then a significant recession in 2007, 8, and 9. But if you take other places, like I think Oklahoma City was one of the cities that we looked at. And what you see there is their economy actually continued to expand over the whole sample that we look at.
For those cities that really were affected by a particular recession, like, for example, Phoenix, where, as you say, it wasn't really affected by the one in the 90s, but in the mid-2000s and obviously 2007, 8, 9.
Mm-hmm.
Did the recession that affected a particular city affect how or if it was able to recover?
I think the housing crisis more recently has had a prolonged effect on kind of the pace of recovery, because this deleveraging process that households have gone through has made it difficult in a lot of places for things to recover. It takes a long time for foreclosures to work through the system and so on and so forth. At the same time, you have seen, you know, pretty significant bounce backs in some places. just because the housing market has really has picked up and recovered quite substantially, and housing prices are, you know, up to, in some cases, where they were before the recession actually hit. So there are going to be some differences, but I would say that kind of the 2007-08 recession was the only recession that we looked at that was actually completely widespread across the entire country.
What do you think it was about this most recent recession that made it as widespread as it was where others weren't?
I think that it started with kind of, if you kind of, there's some maps in our paper and we kind of look at kind of how the recession spread across the country. And what you see is that the recession really started in the Southwest and in the West Coast as well as down in Florida. And that was kind of where the housing crisis turned out to be the worst. But the way that kind of our financial markets are all intermingled, as the housing market started to turn down, that turned into an all-out financial crisis. And those spillovers from the financial crisis end up just propagating through the whole national economy and global economy, for that matter.
So given the fact, as you say, that this most recent recession started with housing, then moved on to banking and other financial services, does that sort of put a dent in the argument that having a more diverse economy in a particular location can help sort of recession-proof that place?
It's a good question. I mean, I think you have to look at it from two standpoints, which is areas that have a more diverse economy have more stable housing markets. So that alone will help mitigate kind of any crashes that you might see in the housing market, and that also insulated some regions. Beyond that, yeah, I mean, if you look at, you know, the financial services industry, for example, there's some places where, you know, it's more today with day-to-day markets. Other places, financial services is concentrated in advisory practices, which is driven by, you know, people's need for retirement accounts and things like that. The healthcare sector also is, you know, nationally as well as in many municipalities, is more or less insulated from recessions because people get sick in good times and in bad, and it's a lot of that's driven by demographics. So there's definitely going to be some structural components that help areas, one area do better than the next.
Charles Gaskin is a regional economist at the Federal Reserve Bank of St. Louis. We'll post the paper he wrote on this at theshow.kjzz.org.
Tomorrow, Mexico will hit a self-imposed deadline for a complete overhaul of its judicial system. The reforms are supposed to open up trials to the public and grant more rights to people who've been accused of crimes. The proposed changes were initially passed by Congress in 2008 and gave all 31 Mexican states 8 years to put the reforms in place. KJZZ reporter Monica Ortiz Uribe joins me to provide more details. Monica, clearly the old system had some problems since these modifications were approved. What was the old system like?
It was shockingly outdated and ineffective. Basically, the old system was better at putting innocent people in jail than punishing the true criminals. Another thing is it lacked true transparency. All the proceedings, again, they were submitted in writing for a judge to review and rule on. There were no oral arguments. There were no public trials. Some people convicted of a crime, they never even saw the judge or had adequate access to a defense attorney. And some of the evidence that was submitted by the police was made up or it was the result of torture.
So in what core ways is the new system supposed to be better?
Well, the main thing is that it forces accountability into the process. The prosecution must prove to a judge with witnesses and scientific evidence that somebody is guilty of a crime. In the past, a tortured confession obtained by police was often the golden ticket to a conviction. That won't fly under the new system. The defense also has a right to review the state's evidence, something that wasn't guaranteed before. So it puts both the prosecution and the defense on a more level playing field. And again, these trials are now open to the public to be present, to listen to the arguments, and decide for themselves whether or not justice was served.
Monica, give us an even bigger picture on this. Why are these reforms important to the U.S.?
So ultimately, it's about trust. You know, most of us wouldn't think twice about crossing over into Canada. But with Mexico, it's a different story. Over and over, I hear police in the U.S. talk about how they can't fully trust their counterparts in Mexico. Well, that prevents us from fully confronting these binational threats like the illegal drug trade. If Mexico succeeds in developing a more professional police force that's less susceptible to corruption, cooperation between the two countries will only grow and hopefully make both places a safer place to live, visit, and do business in. On a more personal note, my grandparents, they used to take their children for long car trips into Mexico for fun. And today, most Americans would be too afraid to do that. And that kind of fear creates an invisible wall, not taking into consideration the actual wall that exists, but the fear can create this invisible wall between our two countries. In El Paso, for example, which is my hometown, the local university and the local military base prohibit faculty and soldiers from crossing the border. And it didn't used to be that way. Faculty at the university used to conduct these important binational studies on things like health and environment, which have now been impeded because of these travel restrictions. So if Mexico succeeds in implementing this judicial reform, and it could take decades, it would mean the country would strengthen its rule of law and create greater trust between the two countries.
Monica, one final question for you. Have Arizona or other southwestern states been involved in trying to help Mexico implement some of these reforms?
Yes, they have. The millions in federal tax dollars that the U.S. has invested in Mexican judicial reform, a lot of it has gone to training. And the ones doing the training are like universities, police departments, and legal organizations. In Arizona, for example, the state police has trained their counterparts in Mexico on SWAT tactics. There's also cooperation going on with other agencies like the Phoenix Police Department and the Arizona Attorney General's Office, where they're doing joint trainings in like oral arguments and collection of evidence, investigation, best practices, things like that.
KJZZ Fronteras reporter Monica Ortiz Uribe. We've been talking about some dramatic judicial reforms going on in Mexico. Monica, thank you.
You're welcome.
Philadelphia has become the latest place to try a controversial idea to fight obesity and diabetes, a tax on sweet fizzy drinks. There's been a sugar tax in Mexico since 2013. There, type 2 diabetes caused by obesity kills around 70,000 people every year. Childhood obesity rates in Mexico are among the highest in the world. So, has it worked? The BBC's Katie Watson looked into the effect of the tax and has this report.
I'm in Mérida, the largest city in the Yucatán Peninsula. It's a poor region of the country that people say has been part of the so-called coca colonization of Mexico. In many parts of the city, you walk down the streets and you'll find little corner shops. They're branded with Coca-Cola, their walls painted red and white. Coca-Cola is very much a part of everyday life.
When in Mexico, you may as well do what the Mexicans do. So I've come for a typical weekend breakfast to Taqueria Iván. Now I'm tucking in to a typical pork sandwich known as cochinita pibil. And there's pretty much nothing else on offer. There's also no tea or coffee, as you might expect for breakfast. The only drink I can see people consuming is Coca-Cola.
Mexicans are the biggest fans of fizzy drinks in the world. The average Mexican gets through more than 160 litres a year. I went to meet Silvia Segura, whose mother recently passed away due to complications from diabetes.
Toda mi familia toma coca. Mi mamá, que en paz descanse, era coca-colera de corazón.
All of my family drinks Coca-Cola, Sylvia tells me. My mother, may she rest in peace, was a true Coca-Colera. She couldn't live without it. Even though she was diabetic, she drank it. She said it kept her alive, right up until the end when she was admitted to hospital. We'd smuggle the Coke in and give her some sips.
I've come to the south of Mexico City. It's the hospital zone. There are lots of different hospital buildings with specialisms.
I met Dr. Abelardo Avila from the National Institute of Nutrition.
What you see every day, how scary is the issue of diabetes?
We are drowning in the problem. What pushed the government into doing something is that we're starting to see the costs of the epidemic break the health system. You're condemning people to death, and it's a painful death, a terrible end. It's breaking the country.
So what's been the government response? Dr. Miguel Mesmacher is the Undersecretary of Revenues at the Ministry of Finance, and helped introduce the sugar tax in Mexico 2 years ago.
I think that the results that we have so far, it actually led to the changes in behavior that we wanted.
How much criticism did you get from the industry?
I would lie if I were to say that they were happy about the tax.
The success of the tax is highly debated. Mexico's National Institute of Public Health, together with the University of North Carolina, said that the tax on average cut sales of sugary drinks by 6% in the first year, rising as the year went on. The drinks industry disputes this figure. Jorge Terrazas is the head of ANPRAC, Mexico's bottled drinks industry group.
We did an analysis, and what we have until June of 2015, it has been just affected consumption and our sales around 1 or 2%.
Which is why drinks companies are now spending fortunes trying to fight this, especially as support for similar taxes in countries like Great Britain is growing. Lee Drutman is from the think tank New America in Washington.
Yeah, there's about $130 million a year spent by food industry lobbyists. If you went back to the late 90s, Coca-Cola, for example, was spending about $1 million a year. Now they're spending about $10 million a year on lobbying. And now as more and more attention is shifted on the role of Coca-Cola's products in health issues, and they're really on the defensive here.
This is a battle that drinks companies may have to fight on several different fronts. Sugar tax, however disputed the evidence, is a weapon that governments from the UK to Colombia and South Africa are increasingly wanting to use in this fight against obesity.
That's the BBC's Katie Watson. For decades, most scientific research has been done using a handful of species, mice, rats, fruit flies, zebrafish, but there are some unusual organisms that are inspiring new directions for research. One of them is the Mexican cavefish. It's blind, albino, and it binge eats like crazy. From our partners at The Pulse, Alex Smith reports.
This wasn't really designed as a challenge. It was really designed to feed families.
Bob Caviar is the owner of Papa Bob's Barbecue in Kansas City, Kansas, and the creator of a sandwich he christened the Ultimate Destroyer.
We put on a half a pound of pulled pork and a half a pound of sliced pork. We put some sauce on it and a couple pieces of bread for stability.
Though many have heeded the call, few have conquered the football-sized sandwich.
We've had 350 people try the challenge. We've had 5 people that have actually finished it.
But even these mightiest of human eaters have nothing on the newest residents of the Stowers Institute for Medical Research, about 20 miles east of Papa Bob's.
So I don't have a lot of fish here yet, so far we have only one system.
Researcher Nicholas Rohner shows off a new lab that's home to dozens of Mexican cavefish. Aquatic beauties they are not. They're a dull pink with mere traces of eyes. They have what look like paunches. It's the result of a strange evolutionary path that may have begun a million or more years ago in southern and central Mexico, when floods swept river fish into caves and left them stranded.
So they had to adapt to this very extreme environment without light. I mean, you don't even see your food.
Rohner explains that the unlucky fish didn't have much of a choice: survive in a nearly barren environment or disappear. So they evolved to become tiny survival machines, but it happened at a cost.
They lost then a lot of traits that they don't need anymore. They lost their eyes because they are useless in this complete dark environment. They have lost pigmentation that's also no longer helpful.
Scientists think these cavefish get maybe a handful of chances to eat in a year when seasonal flooding washes food into the caves. Their entire existence depends on these rare jackpots, and when they happen, the fish go wild.
The fish will just eat as much as possible and as quickly as possible to gain as much fed reserves for the future.
To survive months without food, fish may eat as much as their own body weight during the floods, and this leaves its mark on their bodies.
A similar blood glucose profile like a diabetic patient, or fatty livers that are reminiscent of non-alcoholic fatty liver disease, for example.
But unlike a person who's in the habit of eating, say, football-sized barbecue sandwiches, cavefish don't get sick or suffer from metabolic disease. Rohner thinks that somewhere in their evolution, the fish may have developed a way to prevent these diseases from occurring. And unlocking this ability might be a possibility for humans.
Biology is complicated and it's diverse. And we can see more of that diversity and study it if we look at a wider range of models.
Jessica Bolker is a biology professor at the University of New Hampshire. For decades, labs have depended on a narrow range of research animals like mice, zebrafish, and fruit flies, mostly because they're easy to take care of and well understood by scientists. But Bolker says that other organisms provide unique and much-needed ways of understanding specific biological systems.
Different kinds of research questions are more or less accessible in different models. And by limiting the set of models, we may be limiting what we can study really effectively.
In addition to metabolism, the blind albino Mexican cavefish is particularly suited to helping researchers understand eyesight and skin pigmentation. Thanks in part to improvements in genetic sequencing in recent years, more and more researchers have been using emerging model organisms like the Western clawed frog, the Tamar wallaby, and the Mexican walking fish. But Bolker says the use of these new organisms is still slowed by habit, unfamiliarity, and many funders still favoring the old standbys. That leaves many adventurous researchers feeling like they're starting from scratch.
If you're going to go off and work on something different, you have to figure out how to make it work in the lab, or alternatively, how to be able to do the kind of sampling and get the kinds of information that you need in the field.
As more research organizations like Stowers have started using cavefish, they've undeniably been making their mark. The amount of cavefish research and articles has exploded in the past few years, and a textbook on the subject was recently published. For his part, Nicholas Rohner hopes the genetic mechanisms that keep cavefish healthy despite their eating habits might lead to therapy in humans that will prevent metabolic diseases from developing, whether they're the result of genetics, lack of exercise, or barbecue.
That's reporter Alex Smith. His story comes to us from WHYY's The Pulse, a health and science show. The podcast is on iTunes. Satellites made in Gilbert are going to be on their way to Vandenberg Air Force Base in California to get ready to be launched into space this fall. Virginia-based Iridium Communications says the new satellites will replace older ones used by satellite phones. The launch will mean more stuff in space. And for more on that, I'm joined by John Crisides, a professor of space situational awareness at the University of Buffalo. And John, what's the significance of these new satellites?
Well, they're going to be replacing the old Constellation, which was 66 active satellites. And satellites just get old. Some of them actually came down already that have been replaced. And as with basic computers, you have to upgrade satellites as well, too. These new satellites are going to have much better capabilities, be able to handle more phone calls, and more importantly, do a lot more in terms of data transmission.
So there is a lot of stuff up in space, some of it natural, some of it man-made, like satellites. When a company is looking to launch new satellites, do they have to sort of find open space? I mean, is it possible to do that so that they're not bumping into other things that are already up there?
Yes, they look for specific slots. That's not as big of an issue. Space is pretty big, but the issue is there, what's the possibility of these objects colliding with other objects or pieces of debris? That's the big thing that they're very worried about. The Iridium fly in low Earth orbit, there's about 8,000 pieces of debris that we track that's about at least a softball size. And that's what we're more worried about than you can get the slots. It's really, it's how often are we going to be worried about objects breaking other objects by colliding with them.
Is there a way to prevent that?
There's been a lot of things proposed, but nothing's practical at the point right now. So the biggest thing right now is we're looking at is to be able to track things better, so building better telescopes to look at smaller objects. These objects are traveling at 70,000 miles per hour. I like to use the analogy of two cars going down a lane. If they're together at 70,000 miles per hour, they're never going to collide. But if they're in an intersection, because there's various kinds of orbits you can have, and you can have objects doing this intersection analogy, having two objects colliding at 17,000 miles per hour, that's a very violent collision. So what we're very worried about is the stuff we can't track, like a little piece of marble can go right through the space station. It can wipe out a satellite. That stuff we're very worried about. And there's really nothing we can do about that. We just try to hope that nothing is going to go bad.
Hope seems like kind of a risky strategy for such an expensive and technologically potent and long-term kind of project.
Yes, and so far we haven't had too many incidents. We actually, an Iridium 33 satellite collided with the Cosmos, that's a Russian satellite, was a defunct satellite, back in February 2009. So that's the other issue. We think we can track this stuff well, but we don't know exactly where they are. So for the stuff we do know, we can calculate a probability of collision and then do an analysis whether we have to do a maneuver. It's like playing blackjack or whatever. It's the probability is involved, and sometimes you're going to win. In an unfortunate case, these two satellites, quote-unquote, won and collided together. So even the stuff that we can track, we don't know exactly where it is. And a lot of it is based on hope. We just hope that things aren't going to collide. But it is a big concern because things are only going to get worse as we put more stuff up there.
Well, you mentioned that there are about 8,000 objects larger than a softball that you track. Do you have a sense of how many things are smaller than that you do not track?
So you're looking just below that, maybe like a baseball size. They're predicting anywhere between 100,000 to 600,000 objects. This is going all the way out to much higher orbit. So the 8,000 I'm talking about is just in low Earth orbit. That's about anywhere between 100 to 1,250 miles up. You get higher orbits too. Totally, we track about 22,000 spacecraft. About 90% of that is debris type objects or defunct satellites or spent rocket bodies. The 8,000 I'm talking about is just low Earth orbit.
John Krasidis is a professor of space situational awareness at the University of Buffalo. That's the show for today. This has been a KJZZ original production from Phoenix. You can find photos, audio segments, and more information about the program at theshow.kjzz.org. I'm Mark Brody. Thanks for listening to the show podcast.